Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Evolution of Anti-CD20 Disease-Modifying Therapies in Multiple Sclerosis, Recent Updates. I'm Dr. Stephen Krieger from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York.
I'm Dr. Rachel Brandstetter from the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
Our discussion today will focus on anti-CD20 disease-modifying therapies in MS. We're going to talk about some of the differences between the different anti-CD20 therapies, review data on the latest approval in MS in this class. We'll also discuss how we can tie what we see clinically to what's actually happening immunologically in our patients and the role of Epstein-Barr virus in causing MS. To help us in our discussion, we're joined by Dr. Larry Steinman, a neurologist and immunologist noted for his work on autoimmune disease, particularly multiple sclerosis. He's a professor of neurology and neurological sciences, pediatrics, and genetics at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Thank you so much for joining us. And Dr. Steinman, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm Larry Steinman. I'm a neurologist. I've been at Stanford on the faculty for the last 43 years, and I'm reminding myself that I came to Stanford as an intern 50 years ago, half a century ago. I've made a career in neurology, focusing on neuroinflammatory diseases. Of course, multiple sclerosis is the most prevalent of all the neuroinflammatory diseases. Along the way, I've learned a lot of immunology, and I've chaired the Department of Immunology at Stanford for about a decade, in addition to my duties as a clinician.
Let me ask you a little bit about your clinical work. I know you said you're in clinical practice to some degree still, in addition to all of your research and leadership work. Tell us a little bit about your approach to disease-modifying therapies in this era. We talk a lot about highly effective disease-modifying therapies. Tell us a little bit about your treatment paradigm to get us started.
Yes. Well, we now have a number of very effective therapies for relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. And there's a couple of ideas that I think are prominent and hard to dispute, that early intervention in any disease I can think of is going to give you a better outcome than late intervention. So if you're going to intervene early in a disease, you may as well intervene with a therapeutic that is a very high potency, that knocks down the disease effectively, not just a little, but a lot. So I am a strong believer in using high efficacy disease modifying therapies, especially when the safety of using that high efficacy therapy is acceptable. Now, acceptable means many things to many people, but the beauty of what's happened in the field of multiple sclerosis is that the potent therapies are generally safe. And this allows me to be aggressive and use these high efficacy therapies early and not waste a lot of time with lower efficacy therapies that were developed a generation ago in many cases and approved a generation, meaning 20 years ago. So that's my stance. Come in with strong therapies, do it early as possible, and I think the outcome will be best.
And so with the advent of highly effective treatment options, including the anti-CD20s, and why do we need to improve upon the anti-CD20s that we have, and how has that been achieved in the past few years?
Well, we have now three approved anti-CD20s, ocrelizumab, Kesimpta, ofatumumab, and ublituximab, Briumvi. And two of them are given by infusion. One of them is given by subcutaneous injection. They're all highly efficacious in reducing the relapse rate and positively influencing disease trajectory. I'll have more to say about that. And you asked as I understand it, what could we do to improve on this? So the efficacy is very prominent in relapsing remitting disease. In terms of the progressive forms of MS, primary progressive, ocrelizumab is approved and was shown to be effective, but the efficacy is modest. So what we have for efficacy is certainly gives us room for improvement compared to the relapsing remitting disease, where it's actually going to be very hard to improve on the results in the label for the currently trio of approved drugs, either given by subcutaneous injection or the two by infusion.
I think we'll talk in a moment about the work that you did on the most recently approved of the trio, as you said, of anti-CD20s, ublituximab work that you published this past year in the New England Journal. But I'll say, just zooming out and looking at them as a class, I have found it to be interesting and also somewhat reassuring that the outcomes on relapses and gadolinium-enhancing lesions across the whole class have been so remarkably consistent. You know, it's interesting to me that studies done on different patients in different years by different companies with different molecules have been so, you know, consistent with one another, really replicating the data. I wonder if you can say a little bit about that and if you agree with it and what that kind of consistency means to you.
Well, thank you. I agree wholeheartedly, 100%, with your general outlook. When you have three individual, in this case, three different monoclonals, all showing really strong efficacy in three different sets of trials. These are not identical molecules. They do target the CD20 molecule on the B cell. And the results are very consistent with one another. There's never been a head-to-head study among any two of the three, but it is reassuring. And I think that the underlying science gives us an understanding of why the results would be so consistent, because as we'll discuss, these therapeutics are hitting one of the critical points in the pathogenesis of multiple sclerosis. And that's why the results are robust and why they're consistent between these molecules that are given therapeutically that all target the same protein that's on the surface of the B lymphocyte.
And actually, maybe I'll follow up with a more broad mechanistic question, and then Dr. Brandstatter will take it from there. But, you know, it used to be the case that people didn't think MS was a B-cell-driven disease, or perhaps underappreciated the role of the B-cell. Were you surprised, you know, when B-cell therapies started to show us the clue that they were going to be so profoundly effective in relapsing MS? Was that a surprise to you? Did that change your mechanistic thinking about MS itself, or did you foresee that?
Well, from my earliest days of training as a neurologist studying multiple sclerosis, we knew that there were clonal expansions of immunoglobulin that was synthesized within the central nervous system. And we refer to these immunoglobulins as being oligoclonal, in other words, having a great deal of commonality, common specificity. So it does not come to me as a surprise or to state it in the affirmative. It's totally logical to me that a disease where the sentinel biomarker, if you will, is the presence of these clonal expansions of antibodies, which are made by the descendants of the B cell called the plasmablast, are found in the CSF. So sometimes you look at the facts and you look back in history and you say to yourself, I say to myself, That's a wonderful and logical fit between what we've known, not quite forever, but for about four decades.
And so as we have increasing comfort with and familiarity with ocrelizumab and now ofatumumab, how can we immunologically distinguish amongst these anti-CD20 antibodies that we have available for MS treatment? Should we be thinking about differential efficacy on B cell suppression, doses that we need to use to have the impact that we're looking for? How can we help ourselves and clinicians understand the differences between these molecules?
Well, all of the molecules are very effective in reducing the peripheral B cell counts to greater than 90%. So choosing between the molecules is difficult. One of the points that Briumvi has, the ublituximab, is that you can give the infusions more quickly than you give the infusions for ocrelizumab. So this may be helpful to young adults who have a lot of things they have to do in their busy lives, like get to work, take care of children, go to school, and they don't have that much time to sit around in an infusion center. And that may or may not be important, but it probably is important to the people who have to be in the infusion centers. Then you have a drug that you don't even have to go to the infusion center, the ofatumumab given by subcutaneous injection. This brings up another interesting aspect. There is a benefit from going to the infusion center. You sit in a place where people are thoughtful and they talk to you and you see others with the disease, some whom are doing very well, some who are doing worse than you as a patient, and you say, thank goodness that I'm doing better than that. And as long as the valet parking is good or the transportation to the clinic is good, or you're not in a massive medical center where you get lost and you're not too happy about not finding your way to the right floor in the right room, these are, I would consider them small problems of daily living compared to the bigger picture that we have such potent drugs that can really knock down your disease and let you, in many cases, have a quality of life that approaches acceptability. Because once you're given this diagnosis and you start going on the internet or talking to others, you worry, am I going to be able to maintain a semblance of the life I used to have before this diagnosis hit me? So this is all good news, and distinguishing between the different excellent drugs is, there's not much to say other than what I already have about choosing between them.
Yeah. Well, you have provided a very novel insight for the pharmaceutical industry. Perhaps providing valet parking is going to be the next frontier in patient support programs. We certainly don't have that at Mount Sinai in New York, I'm afraid, but something we could work on. But let's turn to the data itself, or the work that you've done to develop the most recent B-cell depleter, ublituximab. These are the ultimate one and two trials published with your paper in the New England Journal last year. Let's talk a little bit about the study, what it showed, but perhaps also your insights into how you got involved with it, things from the running of the trial, a little bit of a behind-the-scenes take on what it took to bring that molecule through its study and now to fruition.
Well, it's a very good question. The sponsors of the trial contacted me because I've been active in the field of multiple sclerosis therapeutics. The first monoclonal antibody that was approved, natalizumab, Tysabri, originally came from research in my laboratory and really was one of the big breakthroughs in understanding the disease. It was high efficacy, and it had the shadow that it did cause a very serious safety problem with the advent of PML. So I had experience on that front. I served on various committees in the phase two. I was on the Safety Data Monitoring Board. And for reasons that are unknown to me, but I'm very happy about, the leadership of the company asked me if I wanted to be the global chief investigator on two simultaneous phase three trials. I thought that that was a very nice invitation. And seeing how efficacious this drug was in phase two, and seeing that we already had evidence that anti-CD20 was a strong target, I thought that this was a good cause to join with a high probability of success. And one of the few times that guess was predicted, we were successful, and that's always gratifying. I have to, for full disclosure, say it doesn't always work that way.
Well, tell us about the success.
Well, in the two simultaneous phase three trials, it was done as a comparison with teriflunomide. The trials both achieved their primary endpoints, a reduction in the annualized relapse rate. The annualized relapse rate was below a tenth of a relapse a year. I don't know whether it's fair or not to say to somebody when one is wearing a white coat that, does this translate that you might have less than one relapse every 10 years? I don't think so. But what the significance is, no one in any of the trials, phase three trial, had seen a therapeutic outcome that was that strong. And I don't mean to tell you that you can necessarily compare one trial to another. You know, even in the comparator group, the annualized relapse rate has gone down considerably over the last couple of decades. Why that's happening is a story unto itself that is worth talking about. So we hit the primary endpoint with the annualized relapse rate. The effect on imaging was remarkable, but totally consistent with what was seen with ocrelizumab and ofatumumab. One of the differences is that the disease progression was pretty low in both the teriflunomide arm and in the ublituximab arm, so that we didn't see on the Kaplan-Meier disability progression any significant difference. We did see, and this is in one of the figures in the New England Journal, evidence of improvement in disability. So unlike ocrelizumab and ofatumumab, disability progression didn't tick the box, but improvement was something that is very gratifying. And the reason, and this is my opinion, is that the rate was so low that it just didn't achieve a p-value. But it's all there in the New England Journal, where the gate is very high. They don't let you make any remarks that are outside the boundaries for the statistical umpires or referees or experts, is whatever we want to call them. And yet the data speak for themselves, so that that disability improvement was right there. So in my opinion, there's a lot to recommend ublituximab, just as there, of course, is a lot to recommend ocrelizumab and ofatumumab in the anti-CD20 group. So then you're left with, well, they all work. They all work very well. What are the advantages? And I mentioned that earlier. It's the infusion time advantage is significant for BRIUMVI.
And the efficacy data are certainly exciting. Can you expand a little bit on the safety data? Was it what you were expecting, given that we know a lot about this class of medication at this point, or did anything surprise you in the safety data?
Well, not really. Nothing surprised me. We didn't see any PML as we saw in the phase three trials for natalizumab, so that's gratifying, although it's still people worry about PML because it has been seen with the anti-CD20 class. There were infusion reactions. It was usually on the first infusion. There was a case, the most frequent centers for doing the trial were in Eastern Europe, and somebody got measles encephalopathy, measles encephalitis. Whether they were immunized or not is unclear, there's no black box associated with it. So I would say safety was as expected. It was mostly infusion reactions, which were dealt with.
You know, and then to go one step further with the efficacy data. So, you know, obviously the core trials were successful and leading to the approval. And now we can see perhaps some more nuanced data cuts from those studies as we think about how to use medicines with individual patients. It's sort of nice to think about how did people in a trial who are most similar to the patient in front of us, how did they do? So I think there have been a couple of presentations at recent congresses in 2023 looking at that at the American Academy of Neurology this past year. I think you presented a data cut looking at ublituximab in the treatment-naive patients. So, you know, many people, of course, may switch from a disease-modifying therapy to a B-cell depleter. A subpopulation in the study were treatment-naive. And if we're going to talk about, as you said at the beginning, high-efficacy therapy early and not, as you put it, I think, wasting time with lower-efficacy therapies, what can you say about the efficacy of ublituximab in that treatment-naive group from the ULTIMATE 1 and 2 trials?
Well, as you said, this is a really good way of looking at it. If you're going to go into individuals early, they are usually treatment naive, and the efficacy was quite good in the treatment naive population. The annual relapse rate was even lower than what was seen in the overall group. It was 0.08 per year compared to more than twice that in the ublituximab group. And then there was a very high level of no evidence of disease activity. The reduction in T1 and T2 lesions was both very impressive, with p-values with three zeros and a one or four zeros and a one. So it really worked well in the treatment naive group.
And to that point, can you speak a little bit about the data on efficacy in patients with highly active MS, because we certainly are using more and more highly effective treatments at disease onset, irrespective of any what we perceive to be negative prognostic factors. But how about in those patients who we worry about more, who present more aggressively?
Right. So in the data analysis of people who had two or more relapses in the previous year before beginning therapy, it was still highly efficacious compared to the teriflunomide group. The annualized relapse rate in those highly active patients was 0.14, so it went over the 0.1, and that's expected, but it was still more than three times lower than the annualized relapse rate in the active group that got ublituximab. So it would argue very strongly that come in with a strong drug in the highly active patients, come in with a strong drug in people who haven't received any therapy. And I say a strong drug when compared to teriflunomide, which is given orally, but it's one of the older drugs and far less efficacious than ublituximab. So both of those presentations at the AAN underscore the idea that the ublituximab is potent, safe, and the kind of drug that you'd want to give to somebody who has not been on anything else, and the kind of drug you would want to give when somebody is having I call it more than a rough patch, when you've had more than two relapses in the previous year?
I think, you know, all of these gauges that we have about the degree of someone with MS and their degree of inflammatory activity or their you know, prognostic considerations can be useful, but I'm sure we've all seen patients that have had, you know, 15 enhancing lesions, and then 10 or 15 years later, they're doing just fine. And the contrary is also true. People who look to have relatively mild disease early then go on to not have such mild disease. And so I want to pivot here a little bit and take advantage of your expertise, not just as a neurologist, but as an immunologist, to say, you know, how do we bridge the gap between understanding the immunology driving the disease in general and that in a particular patient with the presentation that that patient has in front of us? I sometimes think I'm looking at the patient, I'm looking at their scan, but there's so little ability to really know what's happening immunologically with that patient. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that gap, that unmet need to bridge the immunology of MS to the clinic. How do you see that, and perhaps where do you see that going?
Right. Well, first of all, last year, there has been a big breakthrough in understanding the pathogenesis. But on your question, and we've experienced this as clinicians, we're sitting in front of a patient, we have the scan on a screen in front of us, and they want to know, how am I going to be the next time I see you? How am I going to be in 5 years? Will I be around and walking with my children when they graduate high school and college, or will I be in a wheelchair? And how much can we tell them when we look at that scan and we look at their recent history that took them to the clinic? And the answer is not so clear. One tries to do the best one can as a physician to try to be positive and optimistic without being disingenuous. But I think you're asking a very good question, and my answer is imperfect because the field has not progressed to the stage where we can talk with great certainty, other than to say, yes, we have powerful medicines, and yes, we have powerful medicines besides the anti-CD20s, and we have alternatives, and research is going on all the time. You know, this is really important to remember in a year where I can get up in front of large audiences and small audiences, including patients, and say, you know, we found out what causes disease and what causes your disease. That's a powerful statement to make, but you would think if we know what causes a disease, why don't we have the cure for the disease? We have good medications. We have 15 of them, including the anti-CD20s. But anyone who says the disease is cured is being inaccurate and overselling. But it is the case that I can tell a person, I can tell you what caused your disease. But the two don't go together yet.
So there has long been understood a link between Epstein-Barr virus infection and multiple sclerosis, but as you've alluded to, there's been new data that came out last year. And we, of course, want to hear your thoughts about these two claims that have been made about the link between EBV and MS, one being that EBV infection causes multiple sclerosis, the other being it's necessary but not sufficient. So if you can expand on that for us, we would appreciate it.
Sure, and thank you for giving me the opportunity. I enjoy talking about the breakthrough. I usually start out, and sometimes it's the title of the lecture, there's a big conundrum. Everyone in the audience, or nearly everyone, 95, 97, whatever high 90% you want to use, has been infected with Epstein-Barr virus. And unless you're talking to the waiting room in MS clinic, hopefully very few people in an audience, even of 1,000, actually have multiple sclerosis. So a person can tell you that I even had mononucleosis in college. They might tell you, but am I going to get multiple sclerosis? So how did we get to this situation where we have this conundrum? So in decade-long work by Professor Escurillo at the Harvard School of Public Health, he had access to a U.S. military database of 10 million soldiers, male and female, more males than females, and about 1,000 of them had MS. They would get yearly blood draws, and the blood was available for analysis. And every single MS patient was positive for antibodies to various components of EBV. I think the actual number was 984 out of 985. And that's a pretty strong number because the one outlier may have had one of the other diseases that look like MS, but that's okay. Nothing is perfect. They also had 35 soldiers who went into the military and developed MS, who entered the military negative for EBV serology. Those would be antibodies to various Epstein-Barr viral proteins. And 34 of them who developed MS only developed, of that 35, only developed MS after they turned positive serologically. And also they measured neurofilament light chain, which is a marker of damage in the brain. And that went up before the diagnosis of MS was made. So it was a compelling study with enormously powerful relative risks. They compared to another herpes virus, the cytomegalovirus, which didn't give that kind of signal. So Science Magazine published the paper, and there was the bold proclamation, like smoking can cause cancer, Epstein-Barr virus causes multiple sclerosis. But the conundrum is there, just like we all know people, mainly people from earlier generations or people who live in different socioeconomic circles than we live in, who do smoke but didn't get cancer. Well, you can have an EBV infection, and most of the time you live happily with it. You may have missed a term of school because you got EBV and you were so tired that you had to drop out. So we wrote about that and said that it's necessary to have that EBV infection, but it's not sufficient. What else has to happen? And then in our lab, a young man named Tobias Lons spent about 8 years of his life when he came to Stanford pursuing this. And here's the interesting thing. I mentioned oligoclonal immunoglobulin bands. We all knew about antibody was important in making the diagnosis. So he studied the plasmablasts in the spinal fluid, the ones that actually make the antibody. And he found antibodies to a lot of different viruses that we've been infected with or vaccinated with. So there were antibodies, clonal antibodies to measles, varicella zoster, there were rubella, there were the retrovirus, HER. V was positive, and a whole lot of antibodies to EBV proteins, capsid proteins, glycoproteins in the surface, and also to the transcription factor known as EBNA1. And then he made a remarkable discovery. The tools that we had in our hands are really elegant. We could buy a whole chip that has 16,000, almost all the human proteins on it. And some of the proteins that were bound by the oligoclonal antibodies bound a molecule called GlialCAM. And so GlialCAM has a sequence that shares a really high degree of homology with a sequence in the Epstein-Barr nuclear antigen 1, the EBNA-1 antigen. So this was a case of molecular mimicry. So that got very exciting and gave some mechanistic understanding. The funny thing is, in the Escarillo paper, they're professional epidemiologists, but they collaborated with some super virologists. But tucked away in the supplementary table 1 was a p-value with like 4 zeros in front of us from that very region that the GliaCAM, Epstein-Barr nuclear antigen 1 molecular mimic was. But the story gets even richer, and you can tell I could talk about this for a very long time, but I'll just cut to the chase. There's another molecular mimic in that same region that Thomas Olson and colleagues in Stockholm had discovered called Anoctamin 2. So Anoctamin 2 is a chloride channel, and the GliaCAM molecule is a chaperone for aquaporin 4. So it also is associated with the water channel that's very prominent at the blood-brain barrier. And then also in that same EBNA-1, there's another molecule called alpha-B crystalline, and that has a molecular mimic. And there's one other that's nearby, a molecular mimic to the most abundant protein in the myelin sheath, myelin basic protein. So it's really tantalizing to try to understand how could one, a molecule that infects everyone, nearly everyone, have a transcription factor that has 4 prominent areas of similarity with 4 parts of the story of the pathogenesis of MS, the EBV, the major myelin protein, heretofore not widely understood molecule called GliaCAM and Anoctamin 2, and then this other very interesting molecule that's a small heat shock protein called alpha-B crystalline. So you'll see over the next year or 10, but beginning this calendar year, some fascinating papers on the subject. So there's a lot more to learn and to know. Maybe after we know more, we can start thinking of therapies that get to a cure. So this brings up another issue. The very effective biologics we're talking about, ocrelizumab, ofatumumab, ublituximab, they're biologics. So not a lot of it, and not a lot of the protein known as an antibody gets into the central nervous system across the blood-brain barrier. And I think the reason we're not yet able to begin to talk about a so-called cure is that we're not addressing where those antibodies are being made. They're being made in the nervous system, both in the spinal fluid, where we can isolate the plasmablast, but also in lymphoid-like follicles in the meninges. So until we get drugs that address either the infected cells themselves, like an antiviral, or before we get effective therapeutics that get across the blood-brain barrier better than a biologic, a small molecule, for instance, I don't think we'll be at the situation where we can look a person with MS in the eye and say, I have a cure for you, but that day will come.
What, it's such a beautiful description from start to finish of the findings regarding Epstein-Barr and what you and your lab have done moving it forward. So thank you for that. I want to tie what you've said in this section on Epstein-Barr back to where we began talking about anti-CD20 therapies and point out what you pointed out as well in your commentary in Science, that the anti-CD20 therapies, although they don't cross the blood-brain barrier, they do deplete B cells, and B cells are, of course, a key harbor for Epstein-Barr virus. Could that be the reason why B-cell therapies are so effective in multiple sclerosis, even though they don't cross the blood-brain barrier? Is there something to that? or is there not? And maybe you can take us to the close by bringing together these two themes, B-cell therapies, Epstein-Barr virus as a necessary but not sufficient cause of MS. What can we say about that therapeutic strategy?
Well, a resounding yes to the question, which isn't exactly a yes and no. So depleting the B cells in the periphery, you're blocking the very cells that go across the blood-brain barrier and take up residence, if you will, in the very comforting niche, apparently, of the central nervous system. The B cells get in, they seem to dwell there quite happily and destructively, making those antibodies and attacking the brain. So if you can kill those CD20 B cells in the periphery, and that's what we measure when we draw a person's blood and see you've been on the therapy now, how much of your CD20 population is depleted, we're looking at the peripheral population. So depletion in the periphery is one of the major reasons that these therapies are so efficacious. And that part of your question, I could answer with a yes or no, and you got a resounding yes on that. So, and that's, you know, why a drug like natalizumab works. It blocks not only the B cells, but the T cells from getting into the brain. What we need are those small molecules that would address the B cells within the brain. And so the BTK inhibitors, small molecules, may get us closer to that cure. And then there's a big push to do some antiviral therapies to maybe eradicate infection in the first place. Now that's, you know, with HIV and hepatitis C, chronic antiviral therapy makes sense. I don't know if it makes sense for a virus that almost all of us carry and we don't have MS. And then another thing that may change the disease is the development of vaccines. So just around the same days that the Escarillo paper came out and our paper came out, Moderna, and everyone's heard of that company, is brought into the clinic an mRNA vaccine for Epstein-Barr virus, which raises another important issue. If you are susceptible to MS, or if you actually have MS, do you want to take your chances with getting a vaccine to the very virus that causes MS? So first of all, those vaccines don't have EBNA1, but they have other regions which are of some concern. So we'll have to see. In the general population, is this going to be effective? And if you have MS, should that be an entry criteria which deserves special attention? And I think that we'll certainly, and we have been talking to companies about those issues. But the big hope, like polio vaccine put poliomyelitis in the rearview mirror, maybe the vaccines are going to put MS in the rearview mirror, and it will be a cure by prevention.
And I think all of this conversation really highlights the importance of early detection, right? When we're diagnosing somebody with clinically definite MS at this stage, we're saying they have already widespread central nervous system involvement. And so if we are better able to screen, right, then we can prevent those B cells from taking up their residence in the CNS and perpetuating that neuroinflammatory and neurodegenerative process. So I think it really brings up a lot of themes, this Epstein-Barr virus conversation, but certainly that of how we get somebody diagnosed as soon as possible, ideally before they've manifested with any clinical symptoms.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's right on. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Steinmer, for taking us through your thinking, your work on developing ublituximab, your thinking about Epstein-Barr virus and the way you bring those things together. So appreciate so much your expertise, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of the day out on the West Coast. So thank you so much again for joining us.
And good evening to both of you. Thank you.
All right, so that was a tour de force explanation of molecular origins of MS and the role of Epstein-Barr. Let's start there. It's a lot, and our patients know about it. So how do you talk to your patients about Epstein-Barr virus and what caused their disease?
There's not a week that goes by in my practice where I don't get a question about Epstein-Barr virus. And I think I sort of bring it to the patients the way Dr. Steinman presented it, which is that we are learning more about its critical role and potential causation in MS pathogenesis, but that we don't have all the pieces of the puzzle yet. And that it does seem necessary, but it's not the only thing. And that we have a lot more to learn about genetic factors and other environmental factors that send somebody down this immunodysregulatory pathway that we know of as MS.
It's true. I mean, I think I try to be reassuring about it. I mean, one thing we've always said to people with MS is that nothing that they did caused them to have it. And I want to make sure that they don't think or don't feel as though getting mono or having Epstein-Barr in college was the cause, or that they should have done things differently, or their kids should live differently. So I think it's important to point out what we've learned, but not that I think it has any sort of clear and present implications for their lives or their kids' lives right now.
Agree, and I think by emphasizing how ubiquitous this virus is and that perhaps this virus plays an important role in other aspects of health to kind of reassure them. But I think it has really helped us illuminate further the successes of anti-CD20 therapy. And now we have another anti-CD20 medication to add to our treatment toolkit. And I think that's exciting.
It is. I mean, we've seen from the time we first had approved CD20s to now we have kind of an entire class of medicines with differentiators. You can see how that class evolves, allows us to not just offer like a one-size-fits-all strategy to our patients in that class, but allow them to personalize the decision, talk a little bit about some of the nuances. I think that's beneficial. And I think being able to say that Epstein-Barr virus, you know, is involved in B cells, using this class of medicine takes the B cells off the table, out of the picture. I often find myself saying that it's like pulling the star immunological player off the team. And then that team just can't score additional lesions, additional relapses. They just can't function in that way. It resonates with people. It helps them understand what we're trying to do.
And I think Dr. Steinman brought up a great point, which is that we have to think about doing so in the central nervous system. That though we don't fully understand the pathophysiology of progressive MS, we do know it has a lot to do with compartmentalized central nervous system inflammation, those B cells living in those meningeal compartments, and that we really have to target that better. And so I think that gives us a clearer path forward therapeutically, and I think it does highlight that we have more to do.
We do have more to do. And so we'll be back to talk about it. And until then, I want to thank all of you for joining us for this MedCast program and hope you'll tune in for future ones in this series. Thank you.